This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, August 31st, 1942, an ACLU lawyer is arguing in California District Court that the internment of Japanese Americans is unconstitutional. The next day, September 1st, a judge would rule in the case upholding the government's wartime detention of Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals. This fight and this ruling was really the start of a long legal battle, and at the heart of it was a man named Fred Korematsu, who had resisted the order to report to a detention center. Korematsu's case attracted the attention of the ACLU, and after this ruling, it would eventually go all the way to the Supreme Court, where 2 years later, the Supreme Court upheld his conviction for violating the order, but they also issued another ruling declaring the internment camps unconstitutional. We'll get a little bit into that, but that ruling at the Supreme Court and that moment at the Supreme Court a few years later effectively ended Japanese internment. But staying in this moment of the first year of Japanese internment, the case of Fred Korematsu, and lots more, here to discuss, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
Let me take half a step back and just paint the picture of what we're talking about here, which is 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans throughout the American West who, in the wake of Pearl Harbor, are forced to leave their homes and businesses, first go to internment camps and then to concentration camps. We're talking about 4 years from the spring of 1942 to early 1946. Families broken apart, businesses lost, tragedy. That is the big picture. Now, to zoom all the way in to this really fascinating character of Fred Korematsu and his experience, Nikki, where does the saga begin for him?
So Korematsu grew up in Oakland, California. And I think for him, the story starts with the beginning of the U.S. involvement in World War II. Even before Pearl Harbor, the making of munitions and the reorganizing of the economy, Korematsu had tried to get involved. He tried to get jobs in different factories to help out with the war effort, and he was repeatedly either turned away for being Japanese American or fired for being Japanese American. And he had this experience of discrimination. And then when it becomes clear that there's going to be an evacuation order and that Japanese and Japanese Americans are going to be forced out, going to be rounded up, he tries to escape this. He actually goes so far as he gets surgery on his eyelids in order to try to change his appearance so that he doesn't look Japanese. He changes his name to Clyde Serra and says that he's of Spanish and Hawaiian heritage, and none of it works. He's arrested on a street corner in Oakland and ultimately put in prison for not going along with the evacuation and internment orders.
When I think about this whole episode, it's just shocking to me that he's 23 years old. You know, he's young.
He's so young.
And how terrifying that would be to be separated from your family, to be born as an American and treated as a foreigner, and not just a foreigner, but treated as, you know, an enemy, really. And these internment camps were meant to sever so much, not just family ties, but to really sever any sort of allegiance or connection that you would have with the United States. Which is interesting because they're in these internment camps and they're having, you know, them say the Pledge of Allegiance, and, you know, he's basically saying in liberty and justice for all. And he's like, these are ideas that I believed in, and yet my country is responding to me in this way. For those who were interned for those years, it is an incredibly tragic, painful moment in their lives few people recovered from fully, you know?
And it is worth underscoring how many of the people who were interred not that this makes a difference in terms of the morality of the act, but, you know, we're American citizens. We're second generation, third generation Americans, some who didn't even speak Japanese, but, you know, we're rounded up. And I think Fred Korematsu fits into that. I also want to highlight something you pointed out, Nikki, which I think is such a compelling detail in this story. I think gives you a picture of the reality at that moment, which is, you know, a number of members of Fred's family comply with orders and basically go to camps, quote unquote, voluntarily. They're coerced into going to camps. And then he makes this other decision. And it just is a reminder of such of the sort of hard, tragic decisions that people have to make when faced with moments like this. And there's no right answer, obviously.
Right. This idea that you have to prove your loyalty, that if you go along with this and you comply, then in a way you're proving the government wrong when it says that you're a bunch of enemy combatants, right, or a fifth mm-hmm. column within the United States.
And that, of course, is a game you can't win, right? Yeah. No, you don't prove anything. No. You just simply give yourself in. Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
There's an important background here, too, which I think pointing out that the majority of the people interned were American citizens. Yep. You know, Japanese Americans and Japanese migrants had faced an incredible amount of discrimination in the United States. One of the reasons why they're predominantly Japanese Americans is because immigration from Japan had been largely stopped mm-hmm. by the end of the first decade of the 20th century. And there had been all sorts of discriminatory laws passed and a real sense of otherness mm-hmm. around Japanese and Japanese Americans. And it doesn't matter, like you said, Jody, morally, but legally it does matter that these yeah. are American citizens, which gets us into the Supreme Court case and the California case, because Korematsu yeah, had all of the rights.
Yeah. Which, can I just say as a side note that, like, while Japanese people are being targeted, really all Asians at this point mm-hmm. are being targeted. I mean, no one can tell ethnicity or nationality by looking at someone. And so really this puts all Asian Americans on a high alert.
So what happens in this trial? He's arrested in May. Shortly thereafter in June, the ACLU picks up this mm-hmm. case. What are the grounds initially on which this is being argued? You know, as is often the case, there's a sort of smaller issue here that has bigger implications, but it seems to be specifically about his arrest for having defied these orders and the constitutionality of that.
Mm-hmm. His refusal to comply and basically say, listen, it's of public necessity that we intern Japanese people during this time. And, you know, ACLU lawyers, his lawyer in particular, Wayne Collins, challenged this executive order 9066 and basically said, listen, we can use three articles of the Constitution, nine amendments that say this is unconstitutional, that he should not be treated in this way. But it didn't matter. On September 8th, he was found guilty. The ACLU tried to post bail for him. The military police refused, and they escort him to an internment camp in which he spends a considerable number of time until his attorneys appeal and basically take it all the way up to the U.S. Court of Appeals and then to the Supreme Court, where in December 18th of 1944, the Supreme Court has a divided decision, but a 6-3 decision that detention was, in fact, a military necessity and not based on race. So this is a huge blow to Korematsu.
And it's such a laughable assertion, right?
Yes.
That it's not based on race. I mean, I guess you could say that it's based on nationality, but it's very much a racialized decision. And the Supreme Court is being, I think, pretty disingenuous in the majority mm-hmm. opinion about this. And that's why it's important to look at the dissents as well. So you have the majority saying, somebody like Hugo Black saying that, you know, certainly there are reasons why you would have such restrictions. Racial antagonism can't be part of that reason, but certainly the United States government has the power to intern people if it's a military necessity, if it's for national security. And in the dissent, Justice Robert Jackson he completely rejects that yeah. idea. I mean, he talks about the exclusion order as what he calls the legalization of racism. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court, in ratifying it, he says, is falling into the ugly abyss of racism. There really is a strong dissent that is focused on the idea that you can put all of these pretty words around it and you can treat this as if it's a neutral law, but it just isn't. It facially is not neutral when it comes to issues of race, and therefore it violates the Constitution.
And everyone knows this. I mean, it's so blatantly obvious to sort of say that Korematsu committed a crime. Well, what crime? You know, he's born here. Right. He's living his life in the place in which he grew up. He harmed no one. But at the same time, that is so much speaks to the moment in which people are living, in which this racist rationale was completely accepted, even in the highest courts, that it was okay to treat people, to treat American citizens in this way.
So I'll try and summarize the other ruling from the Supreme Court at this moment. The legal scholars listening here will tell me how I've screwed this up. You can email us, thestatepod@gmail.com. But look, what we're describing here is this interesting thing that I think often happens in legal cases with this Korematsu thing in particular, which is, you know, there's the narrow ruling, and there's the people who choose to view the narrowest interpretation of this, which is there was an order and Korematsu violated that. And so we're going to rule that, yes, he was in violation of a law. And then there's people who saw the forest for the trees and said, no, you know, what was really at stake here is the larger order and the morality of the larger order. And, you know, and so there was this ruling. But then in concert with that, there was another ruling around exactly the same time from the Supreme Court that did take a larger view and basically said that citizens of the United States, regardless of their cultural descent, could not be detained without cause. Mm-hmm. The Roosevelt administration kind of got wind of this and basically at this point wound down the internment program. Now, that's also, you know, I think there's a whole larger political context there and military context of where we were in the state of the war. But, you know, these Supreme Court rulings, especially that second one, effectively take out the legal justification for this, and it starts to wind down. Mm-hmm. So back to Fred Korematsu and his story and his legacy. What do we need to know about the latter parts of his life? Or I guess not the latter parts of his life. He was 25, 26.
Yeah, so crazy. You know, the prime of his life, really. So in 1983, a pro bono legal team reopens the case after 40 years and basically says, hey, listen, there was governmental misconduct and that this person, Korematsu, was wronged. And so on November 10, 1983, a federal judge overturns Korematsu's conviction, basically saying that, you know, he was in fact wronged. The Supreme Court decision still stands, but basically in 1983, they acknowledged that personal justice had been denied and that Korematsu's case really lies overruled in the court of history. And then a few years after that, Ronald Reagan signs the Civil Liberties Act, which puts forth reparations for Japanese Americans who were interned in the form of about $20,000 to each survivor who was incarcerated under the Executive Order 9066.
So interesting, that line about the court of history, because you're an actual court. You get to turn it over.
Yeah. Yes. And you have a record. Yes. Right? And like he still has to live with a criminal record, even if history has judged this as unfair and racist, he still has, for decades, he has this actual violation on his record, which is.
So about 10 years after Ronald Reagan issues reparations for victims of internment camps, in 1998, President Clinton awarded Fred Korematsu the Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor any American citizen can get. And Clinton says something really powerful. He says, in the long history of our country's constant search for justice, some names of ordinary citizens stand for millions of souls. Plessy, Brown, Parks, and to that distinguished list today, we add the name of Fred Korematsu.
I think that there are two important buttons for this story that follow after that. And the first is that Korematsu becomes an even more outspoken civil rights activist after September 11th. And when there's this sense that people are being detained unlawfully. So he files friend of the court briefs when it comes to Guantanamo Bay and the indefinite detention of people who were suspected of terrorism, and really speaks out against this idea of rounding people up. The idea of internment was back in the air in 2001 and mm-hmm. 2 and 3 and 4. And he's out there reminding people of what the U.S. had done in the past and why it needed to not repeat those things. He dies in 2005 while this is still a kind of ongoing fight. But in 2018, Korematsu, the decision, comes up again in Trump v. Hawaii, which is a ruling on the travel ban. And while in the majority decision, it's set, they say, you know, Korematsu is bad law, right? It's bad precedent. They don't overturn it anyway, right? It's still not overturned. But also, that decision about whether the United States can discriminate on the basis of religion does the exact same thing that Korematsu says. It says, mm-hmm. well, there's not actually discrimination on the basis of religion here, even though this had been right. initially floated as a Muslim ban. And so you see Korematsu being, in a way, recreated mm-hmm. in this decision, in which it's actually, it's being denounced in the decision itself, but it's being replicated in the outcome.
Mm. Well, towards the end of his life, he says, quote, "I'll never forget my government treating me like this. I hope this never happens again to anybody because of the way they look, if they look like the enemy of our country." He urged people to protest and don't be afraid to speak up. One person can make a difference, even if it takes 40 years. Mm. So that is our look at the life of Fred Korematsu and this moment in 1942 when the legal challenges to Japanese internment began. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thanks, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or ideas for the show. Email us thisdaypod@gmail.com, or you can find a form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
It just burned me up that this happened, and I was still determined to prove that I still am an American. Having this record given by the government, I just can't feel that I am a truly American because of this. And that was back in my mind all these years.
Radiotopia.